See Realm Radio broadcast for October 10th, 2017.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hello, Bellows Falls. You are listening to Sea Realm Radio. I am your host, KMO. This is the program for the Ides of October, October 15th, 2017. It is an absolutely beautiful fall day here in Bellows Falls, Vermont. The sun is shining, the leaves have mostly turned and are falling. The temperature, it's just shirt sleeve weather. Oh my goodness, what a perfect day. What a perfect day for me to spend inside audio and video editing. That's my day. But hopefully your day includes some outdoor activities where you can listen to the radio. What you'll hear in this hour of Sea Realm Radio is a conversation that I recorded back in September with two co-hosts of an Australian radio program called Greening the Apocalypse. I am the person being interviewed. This was for their show, but I asked Adam, who's one of the two who will be interviewing me, if I could play this for you here in the Sea Realm, and he said yes. So that's what you're going to get as soon as I have read to you these two public service announcements.
Public service announcements removed for your podcast listening pleasure.
All right, so now here is my conversation with Adam and Sarah of Greening the Apocalypse.
This is a podcast from 3RRR 102.7 FM in Melbourne, truly independent community radio.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
More dramatic or like sort of understated or what?
This is a land that prays for a hero.
The humor of the entire situation suddenly gave way to a run for survival.
You are listening to Greening the Apocalypse on RRR 102.7 FM.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. You are indeed listening to Greening the Apocalypse on 102.7 FM 3RRR. Greening the Apocalypse is your weekly dose of future thinkers and solutions-oriented tinkerers. How are you, Sarah Coles?
I have karoshi.
What is that?
You know, death by overwork.
Yes.
That's what I feel like. I just worked
been doing?
All day at the Japanese Inn. Doing a lot of, it's called a Japanese immersion package, where people have the full Japanese experience. Now I sound like an advert. That wasn't my intention.
Is the full Japanese experience? Like heated toilets with squirty bidets?
Really small apartments squeaky. That are too warm from heated toilet seats.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yep, dating booths that you slide into.
Yeah.
I don't, what? Tell me more.
It's just a very small inn in the countryside. It only has six guest rooms.
Uh-huh.
And you just eat Japanese food, stay in a Japanese room, get Japanese massages. It's pretty great, except then a kangaroo bounds across and ruins everything, or a wombat.
Oh, it takes away from the Japanese ambiance.
Yeah.
With its marsupialness.
The critters.
Yeah.
I'm tired.
Well, thanks for showing up.
It's okay.
Good, good. Neither of us has been on the radio for a couple of weeks, and I should mention Adam is my name.
How are you?
I am not Bushy. I'm quite well. Bushy, unfortunately, has got quite a formidable lurgy.
He's got the plague.
Yeah, he's literally got boils.
We've missed you.
Oh, thank you, Jed. That is the voice of our smooth operator, Jed McCartney. How do you go?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm well. Yeah, which is good. I'm avoiding all those people that are not well, Bushy.
Keep them like 100 kilometres away on the mountain. Hey, it's been a really good, it's been really nice listening from home. It's been a couple of weeks of excellent radio. Well done, mate.
It was interesting last week. That guy was very interesting.
Yeah, what was his name?
Alistair McIntosh. The
he was
Scotsman.
So great. People should maybe, if they haven't listened to it, listen to the podcast of that one.
Yeah.
I love that guy. He slayed Murdoch and Trump in the same sentence. I was listening from home, whooping. Yeah, he's good.
Talking about how he comes from the same religious Presbyterian Islander, Scottish Islander heritage, but how they've managed to turn the formidable force that he gained from that to the dark side. It was good radio. Well, we don't have a guest in the studio tonight, but Sarah and I spoke to the very singular KMO about a week ago, didn't we? KMO is a US-based radio producer who is best known for his podcast, The C Realm, where C stands for consciousness. You hear that refrain a lot if you listen to it. He's been making it since 2006 when the word podcast was a new word. And I figured out that between this and his other radio outlets, he's actually produced more hours of radio than This American Life, which usually takes the form of these long-form interviews with smart people. And there's actually a lot of topic overlap with what we do at Green in the Apocalypse. And I've pretty much been listening to him the whole time. And several of the people we've had on the show I actually heard first on the Sea Realm.
So basically you've been picking off his guests for
pretty
our
much,
show.
Pretty much, pretty much.
Nice.
And he's also, I don't know how much you've heard of him, but I always think, I wish I could emulate KMO's interview technique. He's very smart and he's very pointed. He's also a very reflective commentator himself. He takes a deep breath before he articulates himself very clearly. And often he's navigating some controversial or extreme kind of terrain. And
it's like an American Christos Tolkis. He does that. He really pauses before he answers a question.
He does. That's true. And I love both their voices. Although I do have a bone to pick with said Christos. But anyway, let's move on from that.
Let's not start the war with them until they walk into the studio.
Now, a former guest of both the Sea Realm and Greening the Apocalypse is permaculture co-originator David Holmgren, and he has a book called Future Scenarios, which talks about four broadly quite different ways that civilization could go in the future. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
And one of those ways is kind of like a continuation of the path we're on now, but maybe even an acceleration of it, which is I forget his name for it, but it's like the technological explosion where, you know, computers get better and better, all technology gets better and better, and more humans can live on the planet by virtue of that. And another scenario, which he talks about, that the world could go is the opposite way, like a rapid and fairly severe collapse.
Yes!
well, that emotional response KMO might come to later.
Yeah.
So hold that thought. There's two other scenarios. One is a much more gentle descent, one that mirrors
Boring.
The ascent that humanity's been on for the last several generations.
That was boring.
Where we just have a little bit less year on year than we did before. And over the course of generations, we learn to live within the carrying capacity of the earth again. And yes, it doesn't make very good TV. It doesn't make very good novels because it isn't one of those two extremes. But David thinks it's the most likely scenario of all. What he thinks is the least likely scenario, there's one that I haven't mentioned, and that's what he calls green tech stability. That's where we more or less stabilize at a level of, you know, lifestyle that we expect and have come, you know, just in the last couple of generations to enjoy. The only difference being that we're all driving Priuses or Teslas and we've all changed our light bulbs. You know, maybe we're e-commuting a bit more and maybe we're buying a bit more local food, but more or less our expectations for the amount of consumption continue. He thinks that is the least likely. Now, the reason I bring that up is that, well, so you heard this, Sarah, KMO. He's also started doing live radio recently in Vermont, where he lives, on a radio station called WOOL, Black Sheep Radio. And during a recent episode of that, a guest failed to turn up. And KMO had about an hour to fill. And off the cuff, he told a personal story of his journey, one that takes in both extremes of those, in terms of his future outlook, what's likely to happen, of those four scenarios that I talked about of David Holmgren's. KMO, when he started his podcast, he was a techno-utopianist. He believed in the singularity, and that's a phrase he'll use in the interview. That idea that we reach such computing capacity that there are super intelligences and all bets are kind of off. You can't predict what happens after that. So the extreme end of techno-utopia, actually. And it was through his radio show he started interviewing people from the perhaps the other end of the spectrum. And he's going to mention a couple of names, Dmitry Orlov, who he will explain a little bit of Dmitry's thinking. And he's going to mention James Howard Kunstler, who is one of the most biting and sharp-tongued and quite funny critics of American culture at its crassest. And he talks about famously how suburbia is the greatest misallocation of resources that humanity has ever created. And he's a believer in peak oil, the idea that there's going to be less and less resources year on year, and that we're going to enter in either a descent or a collapse scenario. And so KMO's personal story takes in these extremes. And so after listening to this, which Sarah and I both did, we thought, let's get him on the radio, because this is so apt for what we've been talking about lately on Greening the Apocalypse. So we probably should throw to our interview with KMO without further ado.
It's a really interesting one.
Yeah. I really enjoyed talking to KMO, especially after hearing his voice for so long. So this is our interview from last week, talking to KMO from Vermont. Well, maybe just by way of introduction, KMO. So a lot of the things that we have covered on this show in the past have had informing them, if not even stated that explicitly, the concept of limits to growth, that humans might be in a state of overshoot of the carrying capacity of the earth, and that there is a day of reckoning coming, even if that's not like all of a sudden, but you know, that future generations might have to pay for our excesses. Last week, well, actually, when people will hear this, it might be several weeks back, but we talked about the idea of superintelligence with Adam Ford, who's a local expert on that topic, and both the scary kind of scenarios as well as some possible extremely utopian ones that could come as machines vastly surpass human intelligence. And I know that your own personal story actually takes in all of these themes. So I was wondering...
It does.
tell us your origin story, if you will.
All right. I'm going to condense it quite a bit, if you don't mind. I know you've probably heard a longer version, and maybe you can point people to a longer version. But I have been a science fiction fan my whole life. When I was in university, I studied philosophy of mind and philosophy of science, and I focused on artificial intelligence, not at the implementation level, but at the theoretical level of, you know, what does it mean to be a mind? What is knowledge? How much information do you have to have about the world before you start making rational decisions about how you're going to behave in it, that sort of thing. And I was, before the term was really even popular, I was a singularitarian. I mean, I didn't use the term early on, but I did think that a moment of rapid change was approaching, and that it would be a result of the convergence of artificial intelligence, robotics, and nanotechnology. And I thought that was an unambiguously good thing on the horizon. So this is early 90s I'm talking about. And then I got a job with Amazon.com early on. I worked there for 2 years, and it wasn't a lot of fun actually doing it, but you know, at the time it was exciting. It was obvious the company was going someplace. When I started, the whole company, other than the one warehouse, was located on a single floor of an office building in Seattle. I had 3 interviews for that job. The final one was with Jeff Bezos. He used to be in an office just down the hall from where I worked, and the conference room where he would meet with people was right next to where I worked, and he's got this big booming laugh like Jabba the Hutt, basically. And we would just hear that laughter just rolling through the rooms as we were sitting there, either sending emails to customers or talking to them on the phone. But being there at that time, you know, making a lot of money in a short period with tech, when I already had these ideas about what a marvelous thing, you know, information technology was and what a wonderful place it was taking us to, just really cemented that in my mind. So when I started the CROM podcast, and I started podcasting shortly after I discovered that, you know, such a thing existed, I was very interested in talking to techno-utopian people like Ray Kurzweil, who was not nearly as well-known then as he is now. So it wasn't I wasn't shooting for the moon by thinking I was going to get him as an early guest. And none of the people that I wrote to in that field wrote back to me, basically. They didn't answer my calls for content. But other people did, and I got an early interview with Dmitry Orlov, and it was he didn't have a blog at the time. He hadn't published any books. He had a PowerPoint presentation online. It was just his slides plus the text, and it was Closing the Collapse Gap, talking about the Soviet Union and its collapse and the potential of, you know, similar path to the United States. And so once I got Dmitry Orlov on the program, other people who were interested in peak oil started approaching me about being on the program, and that's how I got in touch with Albert Bates, who is the director of the Eco Village Training Center at the farm in Summertown, Tennessee, where I actually ended up living for a couple of years. Actually, I pursued James Howard Kunstler early on, so he was another early peak oil voice that I got on the show. And, you know, once I've had Dmitry and Albert and Jim Kunstler on the show, then, you know, I've got a calling card that I can say, this is the sort of show I'm doing. Here's some past episodes with people you might know. And then it was easier to get guests. And that just started rolling in that direction. When I started the podcast, I had no interest whatsoever in peak oil. It was very much a techno-utopian. I was against the drug war, so I wanted to talk about that with people, but I got bored with that topic pretty early on. And then my personal financial situation, you know, it diminished greatly, we'll say. And I didn't have much prospect for re-entering the easy fields that I had been grazing in prior. And I took a turn for the dark in terms of my worldview, and I started gravitating not just to peak oil, but to you know, other tales of impending calamity. And there's always somebody online who is trying to sell gold, who will hype any, you know, any report or any forecast or any prognostication of, you know, impending financial doom. So I took in some of that as well. And over a matter of years of this sort of echo chamber, selective listening, you know, painting, cherry picking data to get the gloomiest forecast possible, I realized the psychological element to it and pulled back from it deliberately. And also just sort of in a personal reaction, I was chagrined that I had had particular people on my program and given them a platform. So
even your Jim Kunstlers and your Dmitry Orlovs, who I should say, for listeners, are people we haven't had on this show, but very much of the set of people that we would interview.
Jim Kunstler's a fun guy to hang out with. He's a fun guy to be around. He's a fun guy for me to listen to. His persona in print is very different from his real-life persona and his persona on the podcast. So I'm always just happy to talk to him. It's a fun experience. Dmitry, he's got some views that I think are a little raw, a little rugged, maybe for you and your audience. And I understand that. What I like about Dmitry, it's really gratifying to interview him because he doesn't stick to talking points. If you talk to somebody who's pushing a book or they have a very respectable mainstream sort of place in the world, like Bill McKibben, they're really on their talking points and you can't get them off. I mean, they have prepared things that they're going to say and you won't get them to say anything else. And that's really frustrating.
Well, since so Dmitry, our listeners haven't heard Dmitry speak, maybe you could give us just a brief about that article that you interviewed him about way back, Closing the Collapse Gap.
Oh, that's a dangerous one because that is the seed for so much of his later work, and I can go on and on about it. But he was, I think, 12 years old when he left the Soviet Union. He was born, you know, in the Soviet Union, and his parents got out when he was a child. He studied English when he was there, but under a British tutor, I think. So they came to the United States, and as he says, he spoke like Little Lord Fauntleroy, which got him, you know, no end of trouble at school. But he went back. He's an engineer, by the way, so he's a very technically minded person. He works doing a lot with artificial intelligence, in fact, although he is definitely not a techno-utopian, not a singularitarian. He does not think that we should really be fretting over artificial intelligence. But he did get to go back to the Soviet Union just before it collapsed, and then he went back to Russia just after the collapse, and he saw, you know, what a really rough place it was at the time. And he started thinking about what led to the collapse and what, more importantly, what mitigated the collapse for the Soviets. Because, you know, they had state-provided housing. So nobody got kicked out of their house. There was no foreclosure crisis. They had socialized medicine. So there was not a crisis of people not being able to afford their medical insurance anymore. Not very many people had cars to start with. So, you know, and they're a petro state anyway. So peak oil wasn't really a problem. And the subways kept running and, you know, people could get on them. And so there was a lot happening, just not from wise planning on the part of the Soviet planners, but just as it so happened, they were in a better position to weather collapse than the United States would be. And when he was talking about this in 2007, 2008, I think we all thought that the collapse would be visible and undeniable here in the United States by that time. And, you know, if you're dedicated to the idea that there is a collapse underway, then you can look around and see it. But if you're not dedicated to that idea, it's quite easy to look around and say, look, things are fine. Things are normal. So what is all this collapse talk? But anyway, I'm drifting away from Dmitry Orlov. That's Dmitry. That was his presentation in a nutshell, that the Soviet Union was better prepared to survive their collapse than we are to survive ours. And ours is coming. Mm.
And so you said that you interviewed Orlov and James Kunstler and these characters, but it wasn't until you lost your job and found yourself in financial straits that the message really took hold?
It's not that I lost a job. It's that I'd spent all the money I made at Amazon. It took several years to do it. No, actually, I was already in pretty tight financial straits when I started the podcast, but my techno-optimism and libertarian can-do spirit was still holding strong, you know, from my previous life. It took a while to erode away.
How deep did you go into the pits of despair and thinking about future prospects for the world rather than yourself, I mean?
Fairly deep. You know, he's probably a well-known name now, but he wasn't so much then. When I was working at Comcast, which was, I did a tech support job, very similar to the sort of job I did at Amazon, but for much less money. I had an hour's drive to work, so 2 hours on the road every day. And when I was really doing well, I would use that time to memorize poetry, like you heard at the during the sound check. But when I wasn't doing so well, I would listen to Alex Jones. So, I got a whopping dose of global conspiracy theory to go with my peak oil and, you know, climate change worries and all the rest of it, you know, impending financial collapse. That was probably my deepest point. And that was when I was going through a divorce and having a custody battle, you know, with my soon to be ex-wife. And it was just a really, really low point for me. And so I was seeking out confirmation that the world is the worst possible place.
Yep. And have you heard Alex Dunn as Bon Iver, by the way? There's a great track where he's done as a folk song.
I have.
It's probably it's the brilliant. Best thing on the internet.
Company store, the paradigm of absolute control. And that's why we're just out here doing simple things, pointing out that we're meant to be in nature and be natural. And this is where we find the source that God made to transcend the new world order. And that's why they want to try to keep us out of it.
I'm angry. I've had enough of these people. They're a bunch of Christian murderous scum. They're on giant death factories keeping babies alive and selling their body parts. What more do you need to know about these people? I go out and face these scum. They literally crawl out from under rocks. They have green looking skin and they run around screaming, we love Satan, we wanna eat babies. Have them on video.
Hillary's in the creepy weird six stuff, man. She sleeps in the same room with that creepy weird woman whose mother wears a hood over her head.
What the hell?
That woman number one is ugly. Imagine how bad she smells, man. I'm told her and Obama just stink. Obama and Hillary both smell like sulfur.
gets close to that evil and I feel it go.
We're such self-centered crap. We don't even notice hell itself rising up against us. Millions of pointed people of the very worst type, and I'm so pissed. We're gonna stab your daughter at the mall.
If the expansion of consciousness does not loom large in the human future, what kind of future is it going to be?
You are listening to C Realm Radio on WOOL-FM 91.5 Bellows Falls. I'm your host, KMO, and in this hour, I'm playing a conversation that I recorded with Adam and Sarah of Greening the Apocalypse. It is a radio show produced in Melbourne, Australia, and Adam has been listening to the C-Realm podcast for many years and knows exactly what questions to ask to get me talking. So here is the conclusion of that interview for Greening the Apocalypse.
It's probably the best thing on the internet. So I'm really, you know, cautious about going down this route, but I did find it an interesting talking point on your podcast where you inferred that perhaps some of that, like you're saying, thinking that the world might collapse was, in some part, it was gratifying to your ego, which was suffering at the time. But it's a difficult thing to talk about because we're opening the book on criticism by criticizing ourselves here. But how much of your of that perspective do you think was actually informed by an underlying psychological need?
Oh, maybe 40%, but you know, that's quite a boost.
And so you're someone that started off reading Ray Kurzweil, which is about as techno-utopian as you can possibly get. And for those who haven't read The Age of Spiritual Machines, and he's got a new book, more recent book, what that's called, Ray Kurzweil represents the idea that technological advancement will basically get human beings escape from this scratching the earth existence and literally out of our bodies into a singularity scenario where we're freed from all physical restraints. Correct?
Yes. Yeah. That is correct.
And then, so you went from that extreme through to someone who thought that the world as we know it is likely to end in a much more calamitous sense. Now, I actually personally went through a bit of a similar path. I read Kurzweil back in the 90s and I was in IT. And at a certain point, as I started to learn about peak oil and resource depletion, I thought I'd better get out of it because it didn't seem like a career that was going to be of very much use in an age of where pickaxes might be one of the primary technologies. Now, not that I necessarily thought it would go that far, but it definitely seemed worth considering that having more grounded skills, having ones that are universally applicable in all sorts of future scenarios, just was psychologically really helpful. But you went from very high, as I did, in terms of techno-utopianism, down to very low in terms of doomerism. And where are you sitting these days?
I'm focused on a more personal level. I mean, I'm about to turn 50 and I don't really have a career. It's like I haven't decided what I'm going to be when I grow up yet, but I've got a wish list, but I got to really work to make the wish list happen. So that's really where my focus is in terms of, you know, what is the world like? Well, the world is for me largely dependent on my efforts. And I think that would be true in a techno-utopian scenario because
you know, if all of our physical wants are provided for, then we're going to have a fairly intense competition, I think, for recognition and social status. And in a collapse scenario, again, it's going to be the personal efforts and self-discipline and dynamism of an individual and the community that they're embedded in, which is going to determine how well they do relative, you know, to that scenario. So I think that's a pretty good place to focus. And on the abstract level, I'm still interested in all the things we've been talking about, you know, peak oil, population overshoot, artificial intelligence, all of that. It's still intensely interesting to me, but I'm not so emotionally invested in any of it.
When you were a doomer, did you ever wish that civilization would hurry up and collapse? Like, were you excited?
No, because I had young children at the time, and I couldn't really bring myself to wish for them to be thrust into that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was always anxiety, not, you know, not a secret wish to see the whole system be brought down.
I'm with you there. Yeah, we were speaking earlier about how one thing I do find myself suffering from, though, is every time I hear some bad news on the global sense that it is in line with things I've said in the past, there's a little bit of ego involved when I hear the bad news going, see, I told you so.
Yeah.
It's hard to get over that one.
Even when I was in the depths of my doomer phase, one of the core tenets of the message that I was trying to spread to other people who had similar interests was, don't expect to be vindicated ever. You know, the people who thought you were crazy or just really selfishly wallowing in nihilism before the collapse will not look to you after the collapse and say, oh, you were right. Thank you for bringing us this message. In fact, they're likely to blame you. You know, like in the same way that the weatherman gets blamed for bad weather.
You manifested.
Yeah, exactly. Your negativity brought us all to this point.
Oh, it's probably too true.
So what would you say, are you now living with more doubt about where the truth lies? And are you happier now?
I've always been committed to what I call epistemological humility, which is a fancy way of saying, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't really know anything. I have strong intuitions, and I'm predisposed to think in certain ways. But, you know, really following Robert Anton Wilson and Terence McKenna, I've for a very long time, since long before I started the podcast, thought that, you know, reality, our individual realities are what Robert Anton Wilson called belief systems, which he abbreviated as BS. I don't know if that reads in Australia, but
yeah.
Okay. And, you know, Terence McKenna was also one who preached the message of epistemological humility. That's, you know, it's just ridiculous and really grandiose of us to think that our brains, which have been evolved to help us survive as, you know, as he would say, pack hunting apes, but as I would say, you know, socially cooperative beings, that our minds are equipped to understand the entire universe. You know, they were evolved to serve a specific function, and that is to keep us alive, you know, in a particular environment, not necessarily to plumb the depths of, you know, the mysteries of the universe. And so I've always, at least on a philosophical level, stayed committed to that idea that I am agnostic. And it's not that I choose to, you know, not take sides. It's just that I can't really commit to anything that I can't prove. And I don't know how to prove the things that are most important. You know, like, is there a God, or is there a life after death, or is there something to consciousness beyond the brain? I mean, these are just questions which, as far as I can tell, are evidence transcendent. There's not anything you can show me or say to me that's going to tell me that you are absolutely in command of the facts over these questions. So, no, I'm not. I wouldn't say that my level of certainty has changed. It's just the emotional valence that I attach to the images, you know, in my mind. That's what's changed.
Hmm. If we talk about the doomer perspective and the techno-utopian perspective, each of them has an internal logic, which, if you're in the throes of it, is very it's very captivating. And, yes. And I think there's a lot of truth to both perspectives. It's just their framing and their context isn't always complete. For instance, like it's we currently live, our lives are based on fossil fuels. There's a limited amount of them. We don't really have a way figured out of that yet. And to think that we're going to continue on a growth pattern requires a certain amount of faith in our ingenuity and technology to overcome challenges that we haven't overcome yet. And they're possibly the biggest challenge that we have to face. And yet from the techno-utopian perspective, there's actually a really long track record now of Moore's Law and a strong argument that every technological step we take creates the foundation for the next one. And it really feels like these two extremes actually, like, both are pretty interesting horses to back. Yet it's very hard to find a way of thinking about that in a way which brings them together. In like, do you think it has to go definitely one way or the other, or could we see some kind of fusion type future where automation and computer technology creates a class of mega wealthy owners of that technology with AI, and then it could be doomer for the rest of us?
Right. Well, when people ask, you know, what will the future be like, I tend to ask, what is the present like? You know, if you live in Silicon Valley, it's one way. If you live in, you know, Nigeria, it's a different way. If you live in Russia, it looks, you know, different yet. And if you live in China, it depends on what parts of China you live in. You might live in a high-tech seeming utopia, or you might live in a very poor rural setting where people are really just struggling to survive and the economy is dependent on those two or three people who went and got jobs in the big factories in the cities. So I think the future will be the same. It will be very different for, you know, different groups of people, and the lows will be like, I really like the fiction of a guy named Paolo Bacigalupi.
Oh yeah,
the wind up girl. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and Shipbreaker and The Drowned Cities and The Water Knife. These are stories that, you know, show us that technology will continue to produce new abilities for humanity, but the underlying resource constraints will not allow those blessings really to be equally and evenly distributed. And not just, you know, the resource limits, but also just the the capitalist system and the way that humans have always motivated, you know, one another to do work and not distribute the benefits equally. So, yeah, I see that coming. You know, the techno-utopians dismiss really anything that a doomer would have to say. They're not worried about climate change because, you know, nanobots in the atmosphere will fix that over the course of an afternoon. They're not worried about resource constraints because innovation. Or whatever. I think they have a huge blind spot there. But then on the doomer side, there's a complete rejection of the idea that technology has any role to play in determining the course that human civilization will take over the next century or so. And I started the podcast in 2006, which I think, I haven't double-checked this, but I think that was the year that the iPhone was introduced. Now think about how much smartphones and social media have changed your experience of life, you know? They haven't changed the world. The buildings still look about the same. Cars are recognizable. But your daily habits and experience of the world being connected to social media with something that you carry around in your hand has really changed your experience of the world. Now, imagine if I had just, and I did to some extent, but, you know, I sided with the doomers in 2006 and said, this technology stuff, that's irrelevant. That's going away. Pretty soon, what you really have to worry about is learning how to garden and breed animals and, you know, take care of yourself. Well, here we are 11 years later, and that smartphone thing has really turned out to be something pretty significant, at least in the short term. And if you don't know how to drive a team of mules or shoe a horse or milk a cow, well, you're probably okay. So, you know, had I completely devoted myself to the doomer perspective, as some of the people that I like to talk to about those issues have, I would really have nothing to say about the transformation of human consciousness as a result of technology over the past decade, which to me has been pretty significant.
So it's okay if I live tweet my friend milking a cow? Well, like, I'll just hang out with farmers, but I'll be engaged with technology. It's all going to work out.
You know,
If you have the means to both milk a cow and send tweets, then that seems like a pretty good outcome, really. A pretty good – there are much worse scenarios.
Maybe in the future there will be robot cows that will send tweets. That's probably what's going to happen. When you
talk
about
all
the
robot cows are.
I just picture like in the future there will be this seaweed farm in the ocean, you know, farming seaweed so it can capture the carbon – and then and there'll be people in rocking chairs sitting on the porch of the seaweed farm defending it from, like, everyone else. I feel like it's just going to be chaos. I'm freaked out.
Well, there's chaos now.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, you know, most people live through it.
You're listening to a pre-recorded interview that Adam and I did with KMO. I'm sorry for anything that I said during the interview. Two smart people, one idiot.
He actually listened to our Tim Flannery interview, so he got that reference, which was Tim Flannery was talking about massive seaweed farms to offset climate change.
Yeah, it was an obscure reference at best.
You are listening to a Triple R podcast. Podcast, etc.
Well, we warned you this could be a little bit hokey, but how do you feel about – so we're admitting none of us can really predict which way the future is going to go. It's a chaotic system. But there are things that inform how hopeful we feel. And I was at a EcoCities conference a month or two ago, and I started, like, making a list. And column A is reasons to be cheerful – and column B is reasons to freak out. And I just thought, well, let's, I don't know, in a very loose sense, you know, do a kind of what's trending or what's hot, what's not type list. It's not a very deep method, but I don't know, what gives you hope? Let's start there. Do you want to list a few things?
I don't feel the need to reach for hopeful items to hang on to right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, there goes that artifice for our conversation.
We can still play with that. I'm really encouraged. You know, the last time I spoke to anybody for Australian radio, it was in early 2016. And I spent a good part of the interview just explaining who Bernie Sanders was, which, you know, in retrospect is kind of wasted time because he's well known now. But he raised a very significant challenge to the mainstream Democratic candidate against the will of his party. You know, it's the Democrats got sued for violating their own charter and, you know, not being impartial. And it was their argument was that, look, the charter language is just nice, pretty talk and it doesn't mean anything. And we can choose our candidates however we want. And the judge agreed. But, you know, Bernie Sanders, he got enough money just from, you know, raising money from normal people, not billionaires, you know, not big institutions. And he mounted a serious, very viable, and almost won, you know, challenge to Hillary Clinton, who got her money from Wall Street. So that demonstrates to me that it is possible to, you know, it's not a matter of he who spends the most wins. And, you know, he who spends the most is the one who courts the oligarchs. So I'm really hopeful about that. I mean, that is an amazing precedent. You know, I'm not sure that it translates to your political system, but you know, I think there will be analogous events happening for you as well, that through the internet, through social media, through people, you know, really exchanging ideas that are unpalatable to the mainstream media, because the mainstream media has to serve the interests of power, particularly financial power, that we can have things like, you know, the Bernie Sanders candidacy, and there will be other methods that humans will use using technology to organize and thwart the will of those currently in pretty much unopposed power. So that's exciting to me, and that's hopeful.
Okay. Well, there's something for column A. Sarah, you got anything?
I've only got one thing.
What, you've got a list? Do you have column
there's
A?
There's only
column
one
B?
Thing I'm hopeful.
Okay. Jesus.
There's going to be more calamari.
What?
Because of global warming, the Humboldt squid population has escalated, and they can grow to 6 foot long, and they weigh 45 kilograms.
All right, that's
awesome.
So
you can cook it with white beans, have a Sicilian meal. There's going to be a lot of that in my future. That's it for... Oh, wild apples by the roadside.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay.
Social capital. I left that off. I was being a smart ass. But I'm hopeful about proper connections with... I feel like I know some very good people who have my back.
All right.
So I'm hopeful.
That's at a very personal level. You'll get some calamari rings and people who got your back who can milk cows.
Yeah.
Get in the picture. Well, all right. Well, can we make it more conversational, KMO? I'll throw in a few ideas. You tell me what you think. This is what
it's your show.
Yeah. damn straight. Thank you. One of the things that it surprised me that I didn't see coming when I was in the peak oil scene was that just the speed at which solar PV in particular and wind power also have grown. PV grew 50% solar photovoltaic in 2016. It's still, I think, only 1% of the global energy mix. That might even be 1% of global electricity. So it's kind of just... In the noise, it's not like it's actually providing that much electricity yet, all the solar PV in the world, but still it's growing incredibly fast. One thing, I've co-authored a book along these lines. Simple living is actually very enjoyable and it gets you out of some of the stress of the day-to-day living of being in the rat race and connects you to a whole lot of simple skills which are just inherently enjoyable to do and gives you more time just to bliss out and appreciate the simple things. So coming down from the peak of middle-class consumerism doesn't have to be such a terrible thing. That gives me hope.
Yeah.
Network knowledge. You've had people on from the P2P Foundation on your show. That kind of information sharing, some of the culture that comes from open source software being applied to things out in the real world, open source blueprints for machinery and the ability to rapidly... test and improve and do that at a community level. That gives me some definite hope. Technology wise, just things like rocket stoves, the fact that, do you know what they are?
I do, yeah.
So something that is very low tech that somebody could have figured out in the Stone Age. You know this too, Sarah. It's a way of burning fuel which is way more efficient than just an open fire or a Kunara heater, which is a fan force thing we have in Australia. Just way more efficient at turning wood into heat energy, and it's just so low tech. You can do it with bricks and mud, but we only just figured that out. That there's still some things like that. That gives me hope. And oh god, to be honest, that's like the most notable ones on there.
Well, that works.
I wrote that we're less stabby than we used to be. I mean, I do think
that's good.
Less stabby, like. It's just in general, apparently, according to Steven Pinker, a lot less crime now or violent crime or violent death in general than there used to be. But yeah, just humans given a certain backdrop of without resource scarcity, although that could put this quickly into column B, tend to prefer not killing each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's true.
Yeah. Column B is a lot longer. I don't know. Have you got anything, Sarah Coles?
In what? Things that I'm afraid will happen?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, so many things. We've often been accused on this show of being too negative. People listen to it and then say it's like being kicked in the balls. Like, it's just every week we're talking about the things that we're afraid of and then trying to come up with solutions that even it up. But,
yeah.
I don't know. I guess I'm a bit afraid of greenwash. So I'm afraid of compostable bioplastics and Elon Musk and...
Okay, that's a can of worms, calling him greenwash.
Well, I'm afraid that things that are being framed as solutions might not be. Mm. And that scares me.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, this isn't about Elon Musk... specifically. This is just about the lords of technical
you know, techno-utopianism and the Lords of Silicon Valley in general. But I was in San Francisco in 2013, and San Francisco, you know, that's where Google and Facebook and so many other, you know, companies in that realm are located. And prices have gone through the roof. You know, real estate prices are absurd. People who have lived there their whole lives are being priced out and forced to move. And there's a serious homeless problem in and around San Francisco. And you would think that if the Silicon Valley, you know, saviors were going to fix the entire world with technology, they'd start where they live. But it's such a glaring display of inequality and misused, misallocated resources that it doesn't give me any sort of hope whatsoever that their vision is going to transform the world positively for everyone. You know, Ray Kurzweil has this line about how we don't need a breakthrough that's going to allow us to live forever today. We just need to take advantage of all the breakthroughs that add 1 or 2 years to your life expectancy each year. And eventually you'll get to the point where, you know, once technology is adding more than a year to your expected lifespan in any given year, then you're essentially immortal. And eventually the things that he's really dreaming of, you know, being able to upload his personality, that will come along in due time. But, you know, just regular, more mundane, prosaic style of medicine is going to keep us alive basically indefinitely. And, you know, I hear that and I understand the logic behind it. But at the same time, I don't have access to the sort of medical care that I had access to when I was 20. I don't have the insurance. The actual medicine is, in, you know, a doctor's visit is prohibitively expensive. And the idea that, you know, advances in medical technology are going to keep me alive indefinitely is absurd. You know, I can easily be taken out by something that, you know, in better economic times would be no problem. So, you know, that sort of vision that the Silicon Valley types have is highly conditioned by their own experience, and their experience is one of abundance and, you know, ever increasing technological conveniences. But it, you know, the idea that that's going to be shared equally around the world, or even around the country, or even around the city, you know, in which these people live, is demonstrably untrue.
You're on Green in the Apocalypse on 3RRR. We're going to have to finish up our interview with KMO, who is the person behind the podcast Sea Realm, which you can find out more about at sea-realm.com. But it was really great talking to KMO, wasn't it, Sarah Coles?
It surely was.
Yeah.
He recited Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven during the sound check.
Yeah, off by heart.
Yeah.
Well, as we commence the wrap-up, we should mention that Radiothon isn't over. And I've been Adam Grubb. Thank you, Sarah Coles.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeb McCartney.
My pleasure.
Hope you get well, Bushy. We'll see you next week. Until then, have all the fun.
Alrighty, that was Adam and Sarah of the Greening the Apocalypse radio show and podcast. And I'll post a link to that in the show notes for this episode, which you can find on my website. It is crealm.com. That is the letter C, and then a dash, and then R-E-A-L-M, crealm.com. My email address, if you want to write to me, is kmo@crealm.com. I would love to hear from you, although it might be better, if you're really looking for some interaction, to post your comments to the Friends of the Sea Realm group on Facebook. There you will encounter about 1,600 other Sea Realm listeners. Actually, you'll encounter quite a few fewer than that because most of them are just lurkers. There is a handful of active participants, but they're smart folks, and I think that you would enjoy interacting with them. So if you are a Facebook user, and come on, you know you are, except for those of you who aren't, and I know there are some, go on over to Friends of the Sea Realm. And if you do ask to join, you will be asked a question to prove that you are not a robot or a spammer or a scammer. The question is, what does C stand for? And the answer, C stands for consciousness. Hey, I want to make one clarification here. In the interview, I said that there were certain people that I'd had on the podcast that I later regretted giving them a platform. And then Adam mentioned Dmitry Orlov and James Howard Kunstler. Neither one of those two men are who I had in mind when I said that there were certain people that I'm sorry I've had on the podcast.
So I didn't clarify that in the moment, but I want to clarify that now. I really enjoy talking to both Jim and Dimitri, and they always have something worthwhile to say. It's just that I've interviewed both of them so many times that it's good for me to wait a very long time before interviewing either one of them again so that they can each develop some new material and some new things to talk about that the C-Realm audience hasn't heard quite a few times already. And if you enjoyed that conversation between me and Sarah and Adam, you'll probably enjoy the conversation in the next episode of the C-Realm Vault podcast. That will be C-Realm Vault podcast episode number 267. And it features a conversation that I recorded with Adam. This time I was interviewing him, but it's a pretty informal conversation. But this is something that we recorded after the conversation that you just heard in this most recent hour of C-Realm Radio. All right, well, I think that pretty much brings us to the end of this hour of C-Realm Radio. Thank you so much for listening, whether you've tuned in to your local terrestrial radio broadcast or found the podcast online. I'm glad to have you. I'm very happy that you have found your way here and that you are listening to conversation not only about topics such as collapse and the changes that technology is having in our daily experience of life, but also to the conversation about how we gravitate to the beliefs that that we do latch onto. I usually don't advocate memes that fit on a bumper sticker, but one that I really love is, "Don't believe everything you think." And with that simple and friendly admonition, I bid you good day. I'll talk to you again in about a week's time, and until that time, I hope that you will stay well.